Hare Krishna. I'm very grateful to have been invited to be here at the Manor to give one of the 40th anniversary classes. It's my misfortune that I've missed all the others. But at least they're being recorded and saved for posterity. I've been asked to kind of focus a bit more on the campaign years, which many of you, some of you at least, were involved with, and may remember, a number of the big occasions during that period. But and I hope it won't be too boring, but I will give a little kind of summary of all the ins and outs of that. Not that I would expect anyone to be able to remember all this. I had enough trouble remembering it to make a note. But at least it will demonstrate the complexity and and what we were dealing with around that time. But I do want to put it in context of my overall kind of memories and experiences of the Manor. Because it's my 40th anniversary of contact with Srila Prabhupada and taking up the chanting of Hare Krishna, because it was 1973 when I was studying for my exams at home. I was on my own on Easter Sunday, knocking on the door. One of the Sankirtan devotees, Brahamurti, just appeared. And this is the back streets of Belfast, so it is out of the way. And we had a great chat. He saw me in Upanishad. I saw Prabhupada's picture at the back and thought, that's my spiritual master. Took me another couple of... Actually, even that's the year we also got the invitation to the Manor. They were telling me that the devotees had just got this great new place, given by George Harrison. So they were very, very excited about it. And I thought, yes, must go. But it wasn't until 2 years later, in 75, when I actually walked through the door here. And the Manor is that sort of place. And I'm sure everyone has their own experience of first entering the Manor and realizing the power, spiritual presence of the Manor and just its effect that it can have on yourself. And sometimes I come back to the Manor and I still get the same scent that I remember from that first morning. It's that kind of mixture of prasadam and incense and somehow or other, and you just go, wow, that was it. That was exactly the, it hasn't changed. And of course, the deities look ever more beautiful as the years go by. But I remember walking in and all I could hear was the sound of Prabhupada's Krishna Meditations album playing from one of the rooms, and it was kind of drifting in and out of the corridors. And those were the days before all the fancy electronics. This was a record player, and someone had taken the trouble just 20 minutes before to put the record on, but it was just creating this magical kind of effect. But there was no devotees. I was wandering amongst these rooms, It was 1 o'clock in the afternoon in July. There was no devotees around. Finally, one walked past me and said, oh, we're all outside on the lawn. So we went out, and that's where we were having lunch. So I remember taking lunch with Bajahari and Rohini Nandan. We were just chatting about Krishna consciousness and just thought, this is the place. This is really good. What's not to like about Krishna consciousness? Sitting on the lawn, enjoying prasadam with devotees, chatting spiritual philosophy. Krishna consciousness is the attractive process. So I was going to just divide the class into little bits. First one is kind of the Prabhupada years for me, which was from 1975 to 77, the years that I remember Prabhupada visiting here. And I know that many other devotees will have discussed and presented those years in much more detail. And then I was going to do what I call the ICAP years, my years working with the Indian Community Affairs Programme. And then, obviously, getting into the time when I was Tamil president and the campaign. It's taking us up to 95. When Prabhupada, I was only here a month when Prabhupada came in July, end of July 75. And, it was, you know, the devotees were really excited to see Prabhupada. We had nice kirtans in here. We went for a morning walk. Prabhupada did darshan upstairs. But we heard that Prabhupada wasn't actually very impressed, very pleased with what we were doing with the manor. And not really very satisfied, the way things were going. For me, I didn't understand very much at the time, so, but that's what I heard. It was in the after the GBC meetings in 76 that Jayatirtha then was, Prabhupada appointed him to say, go to the UK, sort the place out, and get it going. So Jayatirtha came here and immediately, you know, started tidying up the place, improving things for the devotees. We renovated the temple room, and I was just looking around and remembering actually only the four pictures of the parampara are the remnants from Jayatirtha's renovation. You know, the photographs that were here before were Sadhguruj in the spiritual world, Prabhupada, and the Panchatattva. Lord Nrsingadev came a little later than that. But Jayatirtha did a lot of kind of improvement works and really got things going. Now, we know later there was issues, and I can mention that. But during those years, from 76, the manor and the UK yatra really started to buzz. Things started moving, and there was an incredible kind of spirit of things. So when Prabhupada came back in 76 and spent about a week with us, it was, you know, a very different mood. There was lots of programs, and seeing Prabhupada very pleased. And of course, Prabhupada then decided to return here when he embarked on what he knew would be his last visit to the Western world in the end of August 77. And I'm sure many of the devotees have spoken about their experiences of seeing Srila Prabhupada at that time. It was extremely painful to see Prabhupada so desperately thin. So thin that the doctor who saw him said he should be screaming in pain, because skin, with all its nerves, is now touching the bone. There is nothing in between to protect him from the pain and discomfort of that. I remember just the night before Prabhupada arrived, I'd been out on life membership, came back to the office, which was the guest room upstairs, and the devotees had been in and removed my office chair, and they'd started to put the poles on it for the palanquin for Prabhupada. So I was really pleased. The dire old chair that had been in the office was now going to be used for some transcendental purpose. One of my kind of difficulties at that time was when I would be working in the office at different times during the day, and it really is just very close to Prabhupada's darshan room, and in the summer windows are open and you could hear Prabhupada's coughing and gasping, and you know, Prabhupada was in a very, very difficult physical state. So difficult that even when Prabhupada came down to the temple room for Vyas Puja, Guru Puja each morning, we were told we couldn't sing the normal prayers, Guru Puja prayers, to Prabhupada, because the emotions that Prabhupada was feeling in relationship to the disciples was so intense. Shishi Radha Gokulananda Sitaram Lakshmana Shishkorna Taiki Chenna. So intense that it was, you know, affecting him physically. So Prabhupada would come, the Vyasa was pushed back, and palanquin sat in front. And I remember just a couple of particular incidents from those mornings. One when kind of a long-lost devotee returned and just appeared in the temple room door there. And Prabhupada looked over and gave him a big, big smile. Kulashekar. And Prabhupada was just so pleased to see him. And then another day we were doing this great, nice kirtan. The devotees were up dancing. But it wasn't enough for Prabhupada. So Prabhupada, you know, just went with his hand. Because he was just like this. Prabhupada could hardly move even his facial muscles. So he was just kind of sitting like this, watching the kirtan. And he just did this little... And then the devotee jumped to the sky, and the kirtan, and then this huge smile came over Prabhupada's face. That's what he wanted to see. The devotee's ecstatic in kirtan dancing, forgetting everything, just absorbed in the holy name. Then we'd, at the end of Guru Puja, Prabhupada would go upstairs, and the devotees who were carrying him, it was Amita and one of the others, Raghabir, I think. I'm looking over to my guru, Krishna Moya, over there, for confirmation on many of these points. And they would turn the palanquin around, and Prabhupada would just raise his hands to acknowledge and to thank the devotees for their involvement in Krishna consciousness. That's how I understood it. One morning then, suddenly there was Vichitaviriya, who was the president, came running in and, you know, asked, we need to get a doctor for Prabhupada. You know, urgent problem. So we phoned around like members and a doctor came. But actually it was decided, no, we just take him to the hospital. Prabhupada had warned us, don't take me to the hospital. Don't let them do their things. But the devotees looking after Prabhupada at that time just said, no, we've got to go. So the ambulance arrived and Prabhupada was taken to Watford General. And big kirtan in the temple room, you know, all the devotees praying for Prabhupada's kind of well-being at that point. And I was called just to said, because there were very few drivers around, very few people with a good license, which... I just happened to have one, so it was always kind of getting involved with, there was a need. So they said, Prabhupada, we need Prabhupada's bead bag brought over to the hospital. So I drove it over and I met with Hari Kesh and the other devotees, Abhiram, who were looking over. And it was very interesting because here in the temple there was such intensity of anxiety and worry. But when I got to the hospital, the doctors had just seen Prabhupada, done a little kind of minor operation on him, but enough to stabilize him and to so that he was okay. So the mood over there at the hospital was actually levity. You know, the devotees were just, you know, Prabhupada's going to be all right. And then, so Prabhupada returned, but very soon, within a day or so, Prabhupada then went back to Vrindavan. And our last darshan of Srila Prabhupada in physical presence was at Heathrow Airport. I remember him just sitting at the back of the car, you know, in his normal kind of relaxed scene with his leg up. And just Prabhupada looked so kind of calm and transcendental. He'd, you know, really, he shouldn't have been able to maintain soul within that physical body. He'd just been through, you know, an operation. But Prabhupada just appeared transcendental and then was off on the plane, back to Vrindavan. Back to the developments here at the manor. Jayatirtha continued to really work on a lot of projects, and the UK was on top of the world late 70s. We were developing all sorts of stuff. Just to give you a flavour of the sort of... before I get into that, I just actually wanted to say, The devotees who experienced Prabhupada's presence at the manor during those years naturally see the manor spaces, see the facilities in relationship to Prabhupada's presence, physical presence. We remember what it was like to be in Prabhupada's room and how we regarded Prabhupada's darshan room and his other rooms. We remember how we felt with it going into them, knowing that either Prabhupada was personally present, which was only for a very short period in the overall time scale, but even when Prabhupada was elsewhere in another temple, we still had a particular way of regarding those spaces. So when senior devotees talk about how we should respect Prabhupada's facilities, please hear that in relationship to knowing that they have that remembrance. They have that feeling about what those spaces are. And I think that's something that needs to be preserved and protected. So whenever those devotees say, well, actually, we used to do this for Prabhupada. We used to, you know, look after this. We usually set these things out. And we didn't do that sort of thing in Prabhupada's rooms. I think you've got to really, really think about that and remember that's how we felt. You know, and we want, if anything we can do, is we want to maintain and give all devotees currently the same sort of feeling for Srila Prabhupada's presence here in his home in Bhaktivedanta Manor. You know, it's one of the few places left in ISKCON where Prabhupada performed his pastimes. And it was an intense mood here during those years. And it would be wonderful to try and recapture that same feeling for those rooms. And in fact, all the way the temple was. In many ways, you know, there was, and again, sometimes devotees talk about the 70s as if they were the heyday of ISKCON. The 70s were not really the heyday of ISKCON. Prabhupada was present. That was the highlight. That was the thing that made them special. They weren't the heyday. They were tough. They were silly. We did daft things. You know, there wasn't that many devotees, so how can we say that's the heyday? And sometimes we mix up ISKCON's heyday with our own heyday, we think our best days were the days when we were most enthusiastic. Actually, ISKCON's heyday is now. Really, it is. We'll come to that in a bit. But still, there was a certain innocence, there was a certain special devotional quality of things we used to do. You'd come into the temple. There was one time when the devotees thought, well, you should always bring an offering whenever you walk into the temple room, an offering for the deities. So there'd be some rice or something at the door there, which you could come bring and just give to the deities. So you'd never even enter the temple room without thinking, I am going in front of the deities, Radha Gokulananda, and I've got to bring them an offering. Now that's, again, a very different mood to sometimes the utilitarian way we sometimes kind of wander about, the deity's kind of dharm. And there was many other aspects of that, and the way we protected the sense of devotion of the place, things we would do and wouldn't do within not just the building, within the whole grounds. So you may again hear older devotees, and we sound like we're grumpy old men and women. Oh no, it wasn't like that in our day, you know. And we don't mean it, you know, in criticism or judgment. We just mean that there was something that we enjoyed, which we would love to be the similar experience for yourselves. And that's really all we mean by that. And if, you know, and it's worth taking in that spirit. So, back to Jayatirtha's programs. One of the first things that Jayatirtha did was immediately, actually, I think it was the first day he arrived, he wanted to sort out the Bury Place problem. Because we were having the local council wanted to stop us acting as a temple. Actually, they'd got an enforcement action against that, and Bury Place should have been closed down. And at a certain point, and I won't remember the dates, from 76, it actually wasn't really operating as an open temple. Jayatir, they came in and started looking at the different possibilities, and one of them was, through some of our life members, was a property in Soho Street. And in 77, when Prabhupada went down to see the deities at Bury Place, he also was driven past Soho Street and he looked up, very good. You know, liked it. On Prabhupada's return journey from London up back up to the manor, he said one word. And that word was Bloomsbury. Meaning Prabhupada was so proud to have his temple at the heart of London. Actually, just a couple of other things flashed in my mind. Prabhupada didn't say very much. It was very, very difficult for him to... there was no classes. There was no lectures or anything. But a couple of times he called Jayatirtha and Vichitavirya to his room, kind of urgently. And then they would go in thinking, oh, what's Prabhupada going to tell us? You know, maybe some final instructions. You know, their mind started racing. What did Prabhupada want? So one Prabhupada said, so how are the cows? Prabhupada wanted to know how the cows were doing. Another time he called them in and said, are the devotees getting nice prasadam? So I always took it as instructions from Prabhupada. Two things he would like here at Bhaktivedanta Manor. We look after the cows. Make sure the devotees are having nice prasadam. And Jayatira did take those to heart. Other activities, our book distribution started to really take off. We did, you know, quite an innovative kind of publications. Obviously, there was problems with the Macmillan Gita, so there was a smaller Gita published and a condensed version. We had the Science of Self-Realization, brilliant for book distribution. And then we did a set of three books, which was Nectar of Instruction, was it? Perfection of Yoga and Math? Isha Upanishad as Art of Living. You know, a very clever little package to give out to people. Very kind of completely revolutionary idea, the training of new devotees. Now, this had been started in L.A., which, of course, Jayatirtha had been in L.A. for some years before, and Dhanavir came over, and actually, Rohinanandan started here, and then Dhanavir came over, and we really started working on our Bhakti program and recruitment. We started the Gurukul a little bit later in 81. We installed Sitaram. Lots of kind of artistic kind of endeavors. We had Chaitanya's Instant Theatre, the video studio. Today we've got, you know, all sorts of faith schools, but actually Jayatirtha tried to pioneer that in 1980 with a couple of devotees from America, Padmavati and Kalavati. And at that time, we kind of did try and push and see, is there a scope for a voluntary-aided school? You know, I think we were calling it a Hindi day school at that time, and we were working with people trying to do it. We weren't successful in the same way as Naveen has done so brilliantly recently, but even then, these ideas were on the cards. The folk program developed then, and an early member, still with us here, revolutionary, you know, because prior to Jayatirtha, Grihasthas like myself would be the sort of persons I would have been warning you not to associate with. Jayatirtha recognized the benefit of cultivating household devotees in their own homes. So we were doing revolutionary stuff in the 70s, and of course the manor itself was just getting... more and more packed. And when I first arrived, there was rooms empty. We didn't know what to do with them. But by 78, 79, the place was bursting with the intake of devotees and all the activities. It was incredible energy. So we needed another place. And the place that Jayatirtha decided we should get was Ambassador College. This is before Chaitanya College. Ambassador College. This is the place run by, it's a Jehovah's Witness, isn't it? Or no, it's the, it's one of these American kind of publication places. Huh? Plain Truth, that's the one, the Plain Truth folk. Massive campus, just up there in London Coney. Huge place. And we did put a bid in for it. We bid 1.81 million. We didn't have, have the money. But it was sealed bids between us and someone else. And I remember we had to get the deposit together, so overnight we had to scramble and borrow £50,000 to put as a kind of, to show that we were sort of serious. GBCs came in from all over the world to kind of see it and agreed, well, if you can pull this off, this will be, quite something. George Harrison gave his permission that the manor could be sold in order to fund that. But the manor was very small in comparison to that. Probably, fortunately, we didn't get it. Krishna might have realized that probably would have overstretched us. But it really was quite spectacular. And then a little while later, yes, then we did spot Chaitanya College. And Jayatirtha led the purchase of that. Jayatirtha was also... got me involved in the... I was already on the life membership program, but I was kind of given a little more responsibility. And seeing the sort of initiative and the way he would encourage devotees just to get on with things. He did work very well, and he did get a lot of devotees inspired around him and gave them scope and kind of good guidance so that they knew what they had to do but could get on with it. So I kind of was given an unreasonable amount of leeway within my service. Decided we're not going to just do life members anymore. We're bigger than that. We're the Indian Community Affairs Program. And we were, as well as preaching and fundraising and enrolling life members, I wanted to kind of see it expanded. So one time we'd done invited to a little youth program down in Croydon, run by Nitin Mehta, the Young Indian Vegetarians. And we kind of thought, this is actually really good. And young people seem to be actually interested, in Krishna consciousness, young Indian folk. Because the mood at that time was the older generation were very dharmic, but the new generation were going to get corrupted by the West and they'd be of no interest. That was the kind of prevailing mood that senior devotees would often kind of feel. So we had to kind of try and almost reap the benefit of the older generation's spiritual interest at first. But this kind of, seeing this Indian youth club, kind of we realized, actually, they're just like everyone else. If we explain Krishna consciousness nicely to them, they can get excited. And so we started off the Mahabharat youth clubs. But the Mahabharat Mahabharat name came from, again, Jayatirtha coming up with this idea of the Mahabharat Association. As some kind of larger umbrella involving the Hindu community getting behind Krishna consciousness. So I was going to do my little bit called the Mahabharat Youth Clubs. And we started our youth clubs, first one in Southall. And then we did Harrow, Wembley, Finchley, East London. And later on there was South London, Leicester, Birmingham. They didn't last very long because they just kind of get concentrated because for different reasons, different ones that wouldn't survive. So the devotees from one of them, the local kind of kids, would then start coming to the next one nearest them. And then eventually everyone ended up down in Southall. And then when we were kicked out of the temple there because a couple of the local boys joined the temple, So the local Hindu temple thought, this is getting too far. We can't have this program going. So then we encouraged the devotees, including Shruti, Prana, Atmani Veden, Swami, Dwarka, Jai Krishna. I'm just wondering, Ananda Vigraha, Sanjeev, and actually about 22 devotees came from those programs, and the summer camps, which we did here. So very exciting times for us. And through this work, we ended up getting a donation of a printer, and then we managed to get a computer. And we think, well, if you've got a printer and you've got a computer, when I say print, we're talking about a big print machine. You know, we're talking about one of these massive Gestetner type. So I thought, well, we could do a publication. So we went out, got all the addresses from the libraries. In those days, you kind of think the internet's really good, you know, and you can get information, you know. You can always do that. There's always a way. You know, human society has always found a way to get the information, to get the data it needs to do whatever it wants to do. The internet's just another way of doing it. In our day, we went down to the local libraries, we went through the electorate register, and we picked out every Patel and every Sharma. Well, yeah, we picked out all the names we could recognize, and that became our mailing list, or our visiting list. So then we started publishing the Mahabharata Times in 81. Shruti was our master printer and graphics man. And we would organize volunteers from within our kind of youth groups, and we had sanghas going on, and they would go out and distribute. And at the height, we were distributing to 50,000 homes a publication, you know, on pure Krishna consciousness. We're not doing that now, you know? So, you know, big things. I'm just talking about, and I must apologize, I'm really only talking from my own perspective. I'm not giving the credit for all the other programs that were going on, led by all the other devotees. So, whatever I'm saying, if you think, well, that's an interesting program, you can multiply that by 100, 200, whatever, other devotees doing similarly extensive stuff. You know. Just to give you a flavor of the kind of energy that was going on. So they were exciting times, but in 81, 82, things started to go a little awry with Jayatirtha, without dwelling on it too much. I personally felt that when I used to come to see him and talk to him about programs, he would be very excited, he'd be very encouraging, very helpful. But in 81, there was a change. And he was getting much more into he was getting more into his bhajan. You know, he was concentrating on japa. How can we say that's not a good thing? But something had changed inside where he became more concerned for finding the ecstasy in bhajan rather than ecstasy in devotional service and fulfilling Prabhupada's mission. And I found that when I would talk to him about projects, I'd get nothing. I'd get no feedback back. I'd get, you know, there just wasn't the interest now in anything. I remember feeling a little alone on that one because, you know, I had relied and enjoyed, you know, his encouragement, his wisdom, you know, his, you know, spiritual enthusiasm and the fact that, you know, I regarded that he was close to Prabhupada and understood, you know, what could be done. So it was actually very tough to see that. And then it was at the Vyas Puja, not Vyas Puja, Gaur Purnima Festival in Mayapur in the March that year that he then left and taking a number of disciples with him, which caused absolute havoc in our yatra. I was with Kripa Moya and Shruti and all the ICAP devotees. We just had a big marathon in 81 and decided, okay, we're taking all our team to to Mayapur. We should have been in Mayapur on the day Jayatirtha pulled all his disciples out. We should have been there. And who knows what if that would have happened to our team. I take it as Krishna's arrangement that we'd arrived in Bombay, we'd spent the night there, which is really nice. I wanted to show the devotees Bombay and get them fired up with that. And then the next morning we were to take the flight out to Mayapur. If we'd taken that flight, we'd have been there a day early, and Jayatirtha could have had his pick of the ICAP devotees. But the taxi took us to the wrong airport. We missed the flight. By the time we got to the other one, the flight hadn't left, but the gate had closed. They wouldn't let us on. And we thought, oh, what the heck do we do? So we decided we'd take a train from Bombay to Mayapur. And this was the slow train, stopping in every watering hole along the way. It took 48 hours. So we were trundling across the subcontinent in this train. And it would stop every 10, 15 minutes or so. It was ridiculous. And we would jump out, do kirtan on the platform. And as the train was kind of pulling off, we'd running back and jumping back on the train, ready for the next one. And that's how we amused ourselves for 2 days. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. So we arrived in Mayapur late one evening, and the said, oh, are you the devotees from the UK? And we said, yeah, yes. Oh, we'd like you to come into the conference room. We said, oh, this is nice, a welcoming party. Maybe we'll get some nice prasadam. You know? But no, they wanted to tell us, well, actually, there's a problem. Jayatirtha has just gone. And, you know, we wanted to give you the news and explain to you what's been happening. So very tough, very tough. That's kind of overshadowed our visit. But still we persevered with our trip. We not only enjoyed Mayapur, we went to Vrindavan, then we did a tour of Gujarat. But by that time the devotees back here at the manor who were trying to cope with the fallout of losing so many devotees and all the chaos that was going on were screaming for us to return. So we had to come back and try and give a hand. So in many ways we were negligent. We were enjoying the dams while Vichitavirya and others were trying to hold the fort with just a handful of stalwart devotees. So that was a very tough time. And of course then we had the Bhagavan years, which had their own, in many ways, credit. He came in with the idea we're going to save and hold on to all our temples. Because the obvious thing to do in 82 would have been to sell one of the temples, particularly probably Chaitanya College at that time. But the mood was, no, let's actually try and keep it going. And he did a lot to encourage various programs and to actually give ISKCON kind of a higher profile. But it was perhaps too opulent, too much, too extensive, and we couldn't hold it together. So unfortunately, a decision was taken, particularly by Drishtadyumna, that Chaitanya College couldn't be maintained. Now, this was a decision which has haunted ISKCON UK ever since, and it caused terrible hardship to the devotees. And again, I think, you know, all of us present today need to understand the hurt that was caused, the chaos that came from Jayatirtha's departure, the chaos and disruption to devotees that came when we sold Chaitanya College, and then further disruption when Bhagavan left. These are traumatic years. This is just all within 4 or 5 years this all happened. And it has left a scar on the yatra and a hurt in many devotees that hasn't been healed. Because there was very little we could do to rectify it practically. All we can do is just try and encourage each other. You know, tough things happen. let's just, you know, we've still got the holy name, we've still got the deities, we've still got our association, and we can still serve Srila Prabhupada. And that's all we can do, you know, and try and be there for one another. But I do recognize that that decision caused severe trouble. And it did, in many ways, it did kickstart the campaign. Because what happened was that all the devotees who were living up in Chaitanya College had to go somewhere. And the only place where they could go was down here at the manor. So we had 17 caravans with families living in them. We had porta cabins for the Gurukul and other activities. The place was just chaos, and Hartsmith just said, "What?" You know, the global council just wondering what's going on there. So we negotiated, all right, this is only temporary. And they were actually very good. They gave us a period of grace in which we could move the caravans and then later move the Gurukul and things. But this was traumatic, and it was never going to be the same again. And so it started kind of ill feeling. And then in, I think it was 85, at Janmashtami, Bhagavan announced to everyone, including some the council and visitors from the village, that we were going to buy up Lechmore Heath. And sure enough, three properties plus the shop were purchased by devotees. Now this changed things. You know, if the village wasn't worried enough about the presence of the temple, this changed, because this is dealing with property values, and you don't mess with people's property values. You know? But I want to kind of just, before I kind of go on with the campaign there, I want to take you back a little bit. Because some kind of stories of the campaign say it lasted 10 years. It actually lasted 23 years. It started in 1973. It started when we moved in. And there was opposition from the village from a very early stage. I remember one of the first months I was here, discussing with Mukunda Maharaj, who got some publicity, and he was working on trying to counteract the negative publicity and the negative kind of things people were saying about the temple. And there was a nice report that he'd got saying jet setters, not devotees, are causing the problems in Lechmore Heath, meaning that it was all the people parked at the pub, which actually was the bane of Lechmore Heath, not what was going on in the temple. So from those days it was happening. The first enforcement notice that we got was in 1979-80. And it was Vichit Devery who at that time was trying to work on the legal thing to combat, because at that time Hartsmere wanted to close the temple down. This enforcement notice was to stop all public worship. The same thing we were fighting later on. This was the first time it happened. We appealed, and it was to go to a public inquiry. And because I was working very closely with Vichit Devery on a number of issues, he got me involved helping him. But he was doing the lead on at this time. And he had this idea that maybe if we could put in alternative access into the temple, we could, you know, avoid the village, and that would be the solution. So the idea of the access road was not a later idea. It was not my idea, it was Vichit Taveria's idea. And I remember we walked the full length together and worked out which plots, which pieces of land we would need to get it. And however you divide up the route from here to Hillfield Lane, it's always two landowners, if not three. But you have to get at least two landowners. And one of them was the guy who lived in the village, who was leading the charge against us. So although we did approach him, wasn't very amenable to that. So it didn't look like there was no possibility of it going ahead. However, just before the public inquiry was to start, we were all in the village hall, and our lawyer and their lawyer were trying to do a deal. And at that time, we came up with an agreement that they would let us continue use Back to Bananda Mountain for public worship, providing there was only 6 days in the year in which only 6 days, and on all other days we were not allowed to organise an event, arrange an event, likely to involve visits of more than 1,000 persons per day. Or visits of 1,000 persons, I didn't even say per day, it said 1,000 persons. So that was the agreement, meaning that you could have 6 festivals and the rest of the day just keep it cool. Just do your normal thing, but only on 6 days you can have big festivals. So we thought that's a good agreement. So that agreement was persisting through the 80s, and I was running the liaison with the council, making sure that they were informed which were our 6 days and what the arrangements were. And it was actually going very smoothly. We had a very good relationship with the officers at Hartsmere, 81 to 85. Kink when we sold Chaitanya College, but that we smoothed that over. The mayor was very good, as I said, and we kept on going. 86. The 14 villagers raised letters to the council. The gentleman who I mentioned before, who owned the land over there, who was living in the village, had now become a councillor and was the head of the development services, which means the planning committee. So he and his committee then issued, first it was, they went for a court action to get us to agree to follow the agreement that we'd set up, because they said, okay, you've got your 6 festivals, but on other days, on Sundays, you are having more than 1,000 visitors. We've counted them. And these were the notorious counts, where they counted white devotees and Indian devotees. And they were somehow or other, in their warped minds, they thought that was acceptable. But they would count more than 1,000 people visiting the manor on a Sunday. So they said, ha! This breaches the agreement. We're taking you to court. You're going to get a notice to keep to the agreement. Otherwise, you're going to be in serious trouble. So we went to the High Court. And it was the first of the actual legal kind of things. This was in the spring of 1986. And this is where it starts to get... excuse me if I don't get my dates right or things. This is not history. This is a flavor. Don't take this as Shastra or authority. It just gives you a flavor. So there will be mistakes in all of this. The judge looked at the agreement and said, this is the most useless worded document I have ever seen in my life. Is it 1,000 people at any one time? Is it 1,000 people over the day? What is this thing likely to bring? This is useless. I am not going to give you a court order on this one. So we were very happy he didn't give a court order, but the judge said this is a Pyrrhic victory for ISKCON. Pyrrhic victory means one in which you win, but actually the ramifications of winning are heavier than if you'd lost. Now, it wasn't quite like that, but what it meant was that Hartsmere not getting that court action decided, well, in that case, if we can't force them to abide by the agreement, we're going to tear up the agreement and issue an enforcement order to stop all worship, all activities at the manor. Not just bring it back to the 6 festivals. We're going to hit them harder. So they were very pleased. I remember coming back to see the deities just after the court case. And I was in front of Sitaram and just saying, thank you for saving us. And Ram had a little, in his right hand, he just had a little flower and it just went like that. I thought, wow. Ram was just saying, this is easy. I'm going to be the protector of Bhaktivedanta Manor through this whole thing. Personally, kind of comment. So we then had negotiations with Hartsmere through 86, trying to see whether there could be any agreement, maybe redoing the agreement in a different way. They didn't want to budge, and we couldn't go with what they said. So in January 87, they hit us with the main enforcement notice, the one that was the subject of the main campaign, which was to stop all festivals, public worship, and devotee community, whatever that means. You know? But it was to stop those three things. That would have basically meant that the manor was allowed to operate for up to 50 residents only. No other devotees allowed in the building. This was not a campaign just to protect it for public worship, for keeping the festivals going. It wasn't even just to keep Sunday worship going. Any householder living outside the manor would not have been able to come into the manor for worship. That was the extent of it. It was meant that the manor was meant to operate as a very small theological college. You know, the sort of place where you go and you enroll for a period, you live in there, and it's completely self-contained. No one else comes in and out, no one else visits. That was what they wanted to see happen at the manor. So I know that some devotees sometimes thought, well, we were just doing this to keep the festival. No. Not even the festivals, not the worship. It was to keep the manor operating as a place of preaching rather than just a purely just residence of a handful of devotees. So that was, you know, and there was no question of not fighting that with every kind of breath we had. At that time, we didn't have a patrons program, but we had the devotees who then later became the patrons, particularly we called them together, because they were our best supporters. You know, Rameshwar, Hari Vongsa, and all the others. Is he here? Mahesh was here earlier. And we called them in and said, look, we're going to fight this. It's going to cost us £150,000. And they said, you've got to do it. Let's do it. And they all kind of got the money and it started happening. So the next phase of it was we appealed and the public inquiry was set for the October 87. And again, the public inquiry opened but then was deferred on the basis of another sort of agreement that we had with Hartsmere, which was we would put off the issue of the enforcement notice on the manor for a year to give a chance for ISKCON to find an alternative site. And if we could find an alternative site for the temple, then we could, they would grant planning consent. So it was, that was taken as an opportunity. It was a heavy thing because we loved the manor. We were settled here. But it was taken as a very as an opportunity, and maybe Krishna was putting in our hands, and therefore we had to explore it. And I remember reading, you know, just recently got the publication of Srila Prabhupada's letters, and at one time during that period I was reading Prabhupada's letters, and one of them was regarding the manor, and it said, it was talking, I think it was talking to Mukunda Maharaj about the difficulties that were existing with the village at that time, 74, 75. And Prabhupada said, there are so many nice properties around the manor. Why don't you get one of those and build a temple there? So that was, you know, as far as we were concerned, Prabhupada, you know, was open to that sort of as a possibility. So different sites were identified. Eventually it was Dagger Lane. Dagger Lane is the 40 acres that's, as you go past, you go down Dagger Lane towards the A41. It's the big area on your left near the country park. Incredible site. And that was owned by London Regional Transport. it was considered to be a site possibly worthy of development. They had another piece of land they wanted to develop a business park on. They saw the opportunity that if they sold us the land for the temple, which got Hartsmere out of a bind, i.e. got us out of the manor, then Hartsmere would be pleased with them and give them permission for their business park where they'd make lots of money. So on that basis, they agreed to sell it to us for £400,000. We said, thank you very much. Then a little while later, I went to them and said, actually, I got a real problem. You know, we've agreed to this, that we would buy the land for £400,000, but this is only worth it to us if we're able to build a temple on it. So that's going to cost us £5 million. We don't have the money. So rather than us paying £400,000 for the temple, could you give us £5 million to take the land to build the temple so that you can get your business park? Because you're not going to get the business park unless we get the temple. And without your £5 million, we're not going to get the temple. So they went, what? You want us to give you the land and £5 million with it? So they said, we can't do that. But I'll tell you what, we'll give you the land for £1. So we were getting the Dagger Lane land for £1. But it had to be, we'd had to build the temple. So it went to the council. And there was different things going on. We had our appeal against the enforcement notice happening. We now were putting in an application for developing Dagger Lane, and we also put in an application for the access road using the St. Bart's land and the Wildmoor land. We didn't have the land in our hands. We had agreement from the Wildmoors, but not St. Bart's. But we put in the application anyway. These applications went to Hartsmere in the summer of 88. They refused the road almost outright. And we lost getting consent at Dagger Lane by one vote. That's how close that one came. It was 7-6 against. Just needed one person to have a different view. And we got through. The Labour group were very good. They said, look, we told them to go out and find a site and we'd give them permission. They've come, they found a site, they've come back and we should give them permission. So why are you kind of doing this? And the others were just thinking, no, this is too much. We can't do this. We can't do it. So no access road granted, no Dagger Lane. We're into the public inquiry. That's autumn. We had the public inquiry to test the enforcement notice. And then we had a public inquiry in February after that to appeal against the refusal on the Dagger Lane site. So we were appealing both those. So two public inquiries fought. The decision didn't come through for another full year. So in March 1990, the government, the Secretary of State, made his announcement. Now, just before that, we'd had a little, campaigning was going on, and I'm not giving credit to all the campaigning activities we're doing during this time. I'm afraid in this little time I have, I'm giving you all the boring legal stuff, which I don't think is properly related anywhere. But just a couple of months before we were due to get the decision, we had one of our evening kind of campaign promotion activities here with a lot of kind of local politicians and a couple of MPs, and we had Sir Jay Gohill, who was Maggie Thatcher's favourite Hindu at the time, according to Frank, and he made a statement in his speech that said, nothing is irreversible in a democracy. And when we heard that, we knew what the government was going to do. Basically, he was telling us, you're not going to get it. Another one of our supporters had a meeting with not John Gummer at the time, it was Chris Patton. And Chris, he was asked by the government, will the Hindus riot if we refuse the temple? And he said, no, they won't. Okay, no worries. Okay. On the 16th of March 1990, in March, they issued the decision letter which said The manor should close within 2 years and we're not giving you Dagger Lane. So they gave us nothing. But they gave us 2 years to comply. We then appealed to the High Court. We needed to get an appeal process to delay things. So we appealed to the High Court. Ultimately that got refused. We then went to the Court of Appeal and that got refused. But that process took 2 years. So on the 16th of March 1992, the Court of Appeal had turned us down. Interesting, that was the beginning of the campaigning for the general election in 1992. It had just started that same day, and that was the day Glynis Kinnock came to visit the manor to give her support. So the 2 years' compliance with the enforcement notice began on the 16th of March 1992. That's why the 16th of March 1994 was crunch day. We were told that we were giving you these 2 years in order that you have a chance to find another alternative accommodation. We're being generous. And we did go and we did try. We went to various local councils, and all the local councils were scared to death when they got the call from us. Because they knew, oh my God, they're coming to our patch. Hartsmere are going to get rid of them. Now they're going to be our problem. So they dealt with this very carefully. And they go, oh, don't think we got anything that'll work. Why don't you try Milton Keynes, you know? Further up the road. So we were being pushed around like this. But there was one property in near St. Albans that was of interest. And I remember taking Victor de Vera and Abiram. Victor de Vera at that time was had moved to Detroit and was there, and he was working with Abiram, who was actually another senior devotee who was here with Prabhupada in 77 looking after him. So the two of them came, and because I valued their wisdom, I took them out to see the site at St. Albans and said, what do you think of this? You know, we could develop a nice temple here. They walked it, and they walked it. Then they said, can we suggest something? Rather than spend all this money on a new site and everything this and that, just take that money and get the land for the road. You know? It'll be a fraction of the cost. Just do whatever you have to do. Get the land for the road. So I took that as, you know, correct. That was the way to save the manor. We actually didn't want to move. We didn't want to move the deities. We didn't want to do any of this stuff. Yes, it was a big opportunity and we could develop some. But so unknown, you know, compared to the manor we love. And, you know, if it was going to cost us far more to do something elsewhere, why not take a fraction of that and just throw it at the people and say, give us the land. So we then pushed and pushed, and we were helped by particularly one community member, Venilal Vegela, who had contacts with St. Bart's. St. Bart's used to own the manor during the war, and they ran it as a nurses' training thing. So they still had owned basically the field just behind the Goshala, where we built the cow barns on just the other side of the hedge. They owned that whole field, and we needed the strip at the bottom. So we went to them, and we were offering silly money for a strip of land. And they were holding back. So we started a kind of campaign against them. Look, St. Bart, you're in the paper saying you're going to close this facility, that facility. You haven't got money for all the operations, blah, 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 blah. And here's a religious community trying to give you some money for a piece of useless land, and you're refusing. What is going on? So we poured the pressure on them, and eventually they agreed to sell. And I remember it was somewhere in November 93. Time was running out. That we were able to come to Prabhupada in the morning and announce that actually we now have the land. We've now got the land. And practically the next day, we put the planning application in for the new road. And I remember feeling,
we've now turned the corner. That no matter what the legal problems of the past, no matter what the difficulties, because we now have the land in our hand, it can only be a matter of time before we get the permission to put this access in and save the temple. So the date of March 94 was approaching, and we wanted to do something. We were going back and forth discussing, well, what should we do? So it was decided, no, the actual date is important. It's a Wednesday. It's a tough day to get people together. But it's the day. Nothing, no other day means anything other than the 16th of March. That's the day when the temple is to close. So that's the day we'll do our big walk and march and demonstration in London. And the patrons particularly led the kind of the efforts to pull in the community from all over the country. Frank and the HKTDM with Naresh, they worked really hard on this, and we did our Dharma Yatra, where they went around with C.B. Patel, and they went to visit all the temples around the country, you know, telling them, look, you've got to do this, you've got to organize coaches, come down on the 16th of March, this is the day, we've got to show ourselves. So sure enough, on the 16th of March, the police tell us we had 37,000 people marching in London. We walked from, was the square? Red Line Square, to the War Memorial, and had a big rally there. And it was just incredible. It seemed a little militant. There was no anger, there was no violence or anything, but it did have the flavour of being potentially threatening. Everyone was wearing these orange kind of sort of Shiv-Sain-ish scarves. The Pandava Sain were out there doing their thing. Special branch raising a lot of questions. Who are these Pandava Sain? What are they up to? You know, can they be trusted? You know, are they going to get out of hand? Don't know. You know, they're two young people. You know, they're law unto themselves. Oh. So, we did. We weren't being entirely Gandhian by any means, I think. We were not violent, but we were always indicating that we were hissing but not striking. But hissing is only valuable if someone thinks, well, they might strike. You know? So, after the War Memorial, everyone thought, this is great. Let's go to Parliament now. So everyone walked off to Parliament, and we did a little sit-down for a bit there, just as a practice run, sitting on the road outside Parliament. But I remember seeing everyone at the end of that day. And the community was so, so proud of itself for what it had done. You know, we've never done this before. We've never marched. We've never protested. We've never had a demonstration. We did it. We came together for this purpose, and we have shown them the strength of our conviction. Really proud of themselves, which is great. In fact, so pleased with themselves that 2 months later we repeated it in March, and this was set up as a lobbying of our MPs. So it was only 8,000 that day, but we were all lined up outside Parliament trying to queue up to get in to see our MPs ostensibly. However, when Big Ben struck three, Frank and Naresh led the thing and just walked straight out into the middle of the road. Everyone else followed and sat down. And for an hour and a half, that part of London was brought to a halt. Now that's not, you know, we've got to understand, you know, if you do this normally, you are got karmic reaction. You are causing suffering. You are going to causing problems somewhere for some people. So this, you know, this was not, it was not a nice thing to do. But we did it because we needed to show that, you know, people were serious about the manor. And it's actually an unfortunate aspect of political social life that unless you show strength and unless you show that you can disrupt other people's lives, people don't give you the credit that you deserve. So many times I tried to campaign with MPs. I remember we had a meeting with the Archbishop of Canterbury and we said, look, this is not the way to deal with communities. If a community is peaceful, if they're law-abiding, reward them. Don't reward bad behavior. That's not how you relate to your kids. Reward good behavior. This is the community you should be opening the doors to and giving them everything they need because they're an example to others. But that's not how politicians think. So that was the strength of the campaign. But we had the road was in there. Now, leading up to the Hartsmeer still had to determine whether the road was to be approved. And we had the big decision because technically on the 16th of March, the temple had to close. I remember on the 15th of March here at 9 o'clock in the evening, there was huge attendance from our community. People thinking this may be the last time I can come in to see the deities. If not ever, at least for a long time. That next morning, Hartsmeer sent us a fax saying, well, actually, you could keep the temple open until we decide on the access road. So they were relenting at the last second rather than closing the doors. And I remember presenting that to Prabhupada upstairs in his room and wondering, do we announce this? Do we tell people? Because they're doing this to confuse our demonstration and confuse the community and take the sting out of it. But the message I kind of took from Prabhupada at that time was, no, the temple should never, not for one day should it close. And we will never bring the axe down on ourselves. So take what they're giving. They're saying, we're okay for visitors, not festivals, but okay for visitors. Take that and tell everyone that that's the situation. That the manor is not closed yet, and it will never close. So that's how we took it. Leading up to the decision, it was very clear that although we were getting support from the Labour group, the Conservative group at Hartsmeer were going to refuse the road, so it was all up to the Lib Dems. They should have been supportive, but because they represented Patches Green, they thought, no, it's Lechmore East problems. Mr. Jeffrey's problem is now coming to us. So they refused. Hence, there was the hunger strike protest outside the Lib Dem offices with Pranavana Rameshwar and Aniruddha and the lady, who's the granddaughter of Mahatma Gandhi, wasn't it? So they sat outside for a week and just hunger protest. Unfortunately, it didn't move the Lib Dems, but it certainly got us good publicity and shamed them. Hartsmeer refused the road. The officers actually recommended approval. We had won over the planning officers, but it was simply the political thing of the Conservatives with the Lib Dems that refused it. So we had done a lot of work behind the scenes getting the officers on board. We then went to appeal. That appeal was heard in two bits in February and June 95. This was the big one. This was the crunch one. Could the manor be awarded status for public worship festivals on the basis of the new access? Fortunately, the inspector looking at this was a much nicer guy than the other one. He particularly liked shooting. Shooty was his mate throughout the whole thing. And we had a good case. We actually had a very good case. We had the land in our hand, but they said, okay, you've got the land for the access, but you haven't got enough land for parking on festivals. And that was true. In the years of the festivals during the 80s, we used to park in the farmer's field. The farmer rented it from St. Bart's. And sometimes with his permission in advance, sometimes with his consent afterwards, we would have to park in those fields, you know, on the Jan Mash every night. So it was true, we didn't have enough land, and this could have stymied our whole thing. So we went back to the Wildmore family and said, all right, let's do the deal. Let's take the lot, your 40 acres. And within a couple of days, we pulled off the contract. They were very happy. We were very happy. And David Altaras, our planning guy, was able to say, so, Akandari Das, you have heard from the borough council that there isn't enough land for parking. How much land does the manor actually have at this moment? 57 acres. So, with that in hand, actually, we had done our bit. The decision then went to John Gummer, not a pleasant guy, who was the Environment Secretary. And it trundled on. And there was lots of kind of campaigning in the meantime. We were prosecuted for holding the Jan Mashtami Festival and taken to court. And I still have a criminal conviction. This is a criminal one, not a civil one like we get for book distribution. This is criminal conviction. I think I'm the only person to have a criminal conviction for organizing a religious festival. God. You know, not since the days of the Inquisition. You know, in the Middle Ages or something. Has that been used? But in May 96, the landscape of British politics was changing. And we had always had a very good relationship with the Labour Party. And actually that was Frank's work, because not all the Labour councillors were on our side before Frank. One by one he pulled them in and made it the policy of the Labour Party of Hartsmere to support the temple. And they had made that clear at the public inquiry, and they'd always said, if we ever come to power, we will give you whatever you need. Now, at that time, we thought we'd have more chance of seeing the pigs fly, you know, over the manor before we thought Hartsmere would ever change colour. But in May 96, it happened. Now, the decision was due any minute. And I heard from our solicitor that he had met with John Gummer, and John Gummer had said, I've got two reports from the inspector. One approves the manor, one rejects it. Which should I give out? So this is what they do. They write two reports, all the same stuff, but one says, okay, bearing up all these things, we should refuse. Oh, bearing up all these things, we should approve. It's political. You've got to sort out the legal arguments, you've got to sort out all the practical arguments, but ultimately the decision is political. So, Naresh did a very interesting thing. When Labour took power in Hartsmere, they said, right, one of the first things we're going to do is meet with the temple and start sorting it out. So a meeting was arranged for that Friday. Naresh contacted, without us knowing about it, the press, and there was a piece on the ITV news at midday saying the campaign for the manor, for the temple, is taking a new twist. Hartsmere are now controlled by the Labour Party. They're now meeting with the members of the temple and perhaps might work out a new deal. Whilst we were at that meeting, the Department of the Environment thought, they're going to give it anyway, we're going to lose out. So they faxed over the decision. So while we're at the meeting, there was a call from the manor saying, there's a fax just coming from the DOE. I think it's the decision letter. This is Trebogananda, poor Trebogananda, looking at a huge ream of fax paper. And we said, what do you think it says? And he says, oh, I don't know. I think it's good. Because you really can't tell, you know, very clearly from these things. I said, all right, don't say anything to anyone. We're coming back there. So the whole team went back, and sure enough, they had granted everything we wanted. Public worship, public festivals, the access road. And maybe. So, big celebrations, but we had 3 months. But the thing was that those public worship festivals could not begin until we put in the access road. We had 3 months to do that before Jen Ashtami. Impossible to build 2/3 of a mile of new road through absolute open country. We had to do the transfer of the land because we had options. We'd secured options. We hadn't paid necessarily for everything. We'd got options. So we had to kind of exercise those. Besides the building the road to all their kind of standards, we had to change the junction at the A41, the top of Sandy Lane. All those traffic lights we had to put in. You know, there was nothing there. That was just an open junction. But they recognized that if we're going to be everyone using the temple, there has to be traffic lights and all that sort of stuff. So how do you get the highways authority to change that? And then signage up all around. So an engineer came and he said, actually, you know, you've got this special soil here. It's sand and clay. Because of that, we can use a system that the Romans used, which is lime fortification. And it's really quick. So basically, you scrape off the topsoil, you get this big machine which churns the subsoil and mixes lime into it. And then just... and you roll it. And that sets like concrete. But it's better than lime is better than concrete. And then you just put your tarmac over the top. Dead easy. And the highways thing turned out that the person who was in charge of the A41 at the time was a Ricky Patel. So he saw the request came in and looked and said, well, actually, we are doing some works on the A41, and I could very easily and probably most, you know, conveniently put the two together. You know, I'm not doing anything. You know, actually, that would be the most sensible way of doing it. So he made sure it was fast-tracked on the back of some other work that was due to happen at that same time. The lights went in before the road was finished. So we were then one day away from Jen Ashtami, and Hartsmere came and said, sorry, you haven't got the chippings on the road. And it's not finished. So scramble around Yellow Pages. Lorry loads of chippings arrived that afternoon. Hartsmere back out in the evening. Okay, it's finished. You can have your festival tomorrow. And then we had the highways authority back on us about the signage. And they said, oh, you're meant to have signage all around the place, you know. And it's not just one or two signs. We kind of need you to have signs, on almost every junction in the area. We think, really? He said, yeah, no, I know this is a big, we're putting this demand on it, you know, and there's no kind of way out. You can't refuse. We need you to have all these signs. So you want us to have all these signs saying Hare Krishna Temple everywhere around the area. Okay. thank you very much. So, amazing scenes. Anyway, I wanted to say a lot of thanks to devotees. And I apologize if I'm going over time, and I'll be very sensitive to that. Particularly, I wanted to say to the two confidants who kind of helped me through the whole period, that was Pranabandhu and Shri Dharmaprabhu. So thank you very much for that. Thanks to all the devotees of the Patrons Council, because they were the extended kind of council. They were the ones who we discussed everything with. And the Temple Council. The Temple Council were incredible during those years. because they not only had to try and understand all the legal issues, but they were also trying to kind of keep the temple going in the midst of all this mess and uncertainty. The worst thing for the devotees during this time was uncertainty. What's happening? There was so much we couldn't do, so much, you know, we couldn't start new programs, we couldn't develop things. We didn't know what was going to be the future. And that's, putting everything in limbo like that is very, very hard. So, thanks to the Patrons Council and the Temple Council who carried us through all those years so well. Of course, we're going to say thanks to the legal team, and particularly those who are still with us, David Altaras and Peter Trevelyan, still involved to this day. Thanks to kind of particularly Frank Ward. You know, he was tireless. He was indomitable. He, you know, there was no way he was going to let this happen. And to have that energy always around, which is never, ever going to accept defeat. You know, it was a big boost to me and to the other devotees and to the community. You know? So, our appreciation. And Naresh and the HKTDM, before that, the Save the Temple campaign and High Sot, which is Hindu youth saving our temple, and the Pandava Sain, you know, and all the other people involved in different ways. It's actually, you cannot imagine the number of people involved at all levels. There was academics, there was various politicians helping us, there was interfaith people. You know, there was so much goodwill towards us during those years generated. And, you know, I've really only given a flavour, and I've given a very kind of self-centred kind of impression of what the campaign was about. Just, you know, because they're the things I was involved in directly. And but the extent of the work that was being done by everyone, you know, it was really incredible. And these things don't go far enough. The Mana devotees suffered during that time in many ways, as I say, because of the uncertainty, the difficulties, the distraction of it all. But, so, I apologize for the difficulties to them, and particularly their thanks, and to the congregation who got behind all the events and trusted that if we said, well, we're going to protest like this, or we're going to fight it like this, they just said, yep, we'll support. So, you know, it's just a huge sense of gratitude to everyone involved in all those years. Also want to kind of apologize for all the mistakes made, not just during the campaign years, but during all my years at the Manor, not just as TP, but in every other service I did. It's very easy to hurt other devotees. It doesn't take very much. And I've had the experience of a couple of devotees coming to me and saying, do you know what you said to me at such and such a time, or how you dealt with me on this particular occasion? And sometimes I can remember those. And I say a couple, it's a lot. And sometimes I can remember the incident, and sometimes I just can't. I don't remember that thing at all. I don't remember saying that, doing that, but I know I must have. And yet another devotee was hurt badly by that. So our actions as devotees, you know, do hurt one another, and particularly when we're in authority and have some kind of influence or, you know, responsibility over someone, it's very easy to kind of do something which takes away and hurts them. And so I apologize for all those. And if there is anyone who needs to tell me about a particular incident, I'd actually be very grateful, because I do feel I need to unburden myself from that that load. Just want to take a couple of minutes just to say, you know, I talked up to 96 as if that was the end of the world and, you know, everything. And in many ways, it was the new beginning for the manor. I was already living, by 96, I was already living in Wales as part of the efforts we were trying to make for devotee community, which is another story entirely. But over the years, I obviously get a chance to visit the manor, and I've seen it grow and develop. It's looking absolutely beautiful. I just get a thrill every time I drive in and just get a sense of the place. And I just wanted to offer, again, sincere thanks and appreciation for all the devotees who have been serving here in all those years, since 95, 96, and what you have developed here at the manor. And it is the light of the world, Bhaktivedanta Manor. There's no temple in the Western Hemisphere that compares with it. It's just stunning. Perhaps over the campaign years, even in the years before that, when we were battling the anti-cult, when we were trying to establish the temple, we did play on the fact that we were of such importance to the Hindu community. And that was quite right. It is right. And it was right to do it. The challenge that we have is that we are now poised for big preaching, but we may have to counteract a little of the impression we have given in the past. We have to counteract the impression that now many politicians, or maybe academics, or maybe other people, or just ordinary people, have that Bhaktivedanta Manor is primarily of relevance for the Hindu community. That our programs, that our outreach, that our social work, that our ministering is primarily of relevance to the Hindu community. Now, of course, we are the prime minister to the Hindu community. But we also want people to understand that Krishna consciousness has absolute relevance for everyone. Our scriptures are not Hindu scriptures. They are scriptures for everyone. Our mantra is a mantra for everyone. Our deities are to be worshipped by everyone. Krishna consciousness is for everyone. That's the vision that Srila Prabhupada had. Prabhupada originally wanted India to get behind his preaching, support him coming to the West, to make his preaching in the West and all over the world successful and quick and effective. He didn't get that help in India. So he developed a plan. Come to the West, show the preaching, bring back some Western devotees, and show India what they're leaving behind. Then get them fired up. That was step one, was getting the Western devotees. Step two was going back to India. But that wasn't the final thing at all. The final step is for Krishna consciousness to go global. So Prabhupada wanted India then to kind of get behind the preaching of Krishna consciousness worldwide. The same thing happened in the UK. Prabhupada sent his devotees from America, and we've heard the stories throughout the 40th anniversary of that. Brilliant. He made new devotees here. Because of those Western devotees in the early 70s, the Hindu community kind of did get behind the manor. And have developed in the way it has. Now, we all have to work together to make Bhaktivedanta Manor acceptable, accessible, recognizable, you know, to everyone as their temple. We want people not to think of this in terms of a denomination or a religion or a particular faith, but for everyone in the country to go, this is our temple. Krishna consciousness is for us. So that, I think, is our challenge. But we're so well poised. We have everything. You know, the financial stability that the temple enjoys now. Oh, we only dreamed of that. In 1986, we were £1 million in debt in this country. And that's when the campaign started. We had to kind of have programs to try and sort that out. After Bhagwan left, we were £1 million in debt. It was outrageous. We are so well poised, so well respected, that great position now. So please take the preaching forward, and I look forward to kind of the association of all the devotees in the years to come in preaching Krishna consciousness. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Bhaktivedanta Manadam ki jai, Shri Shri Radha Gokulananda ki jai, Sitaram Lakshmananda Shri Shri Gornatai ki jai. Hare Krishna.